So there's these very big picture similarities between what's going on in a neural network and the brain. But in terms of how everything is actually implemented, most things are actually different. Brain surgery is not a simple task. And
okay. Oh, really? Okay.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. This is Paul Middlebrooks, and thank you for listening. This is really a joy for me to speak with so many interesting people, and I hope it makes your ears happy too. If you like the show, please tell a friend or go give it an honest review on iTunes. Those actions help a lot. Okay, I'll start with just a little bit of news here. I have a few interviews coming up that I'm looking forward to. I'm talking with Blake Richards and Adam Marblestone soon, both of whom are working on how deep learning might be implemented in the brain. I'll be talking with Nico Kregiscourt, who has pioneered this kind of work as well, and he runs the annual conference on cognitive computational neuroscience. And when we talk, that conference will have just happened, so I'll be sure to ask him for some highlights. And guess what, guys? I will be interviewing, wait for it, a female. Grace Lindsay works with convolutional neural networks and brains, and she co-hosts the podcast Unsupervised Thinking, where they dive into and explain a lot of concepts in the field of AI and neuroscience. So you should check out her show. At some point here, I'm going to veer away from these deep learning topics and get into some topics like neuromorphics, reinforcement learning, brain-machine interfaces, some other topics. But I've learned a lot so far here. I hope you have too. And there's still a ton to cover in the deep learning meets neuroscience world. So I won't be going away from it for too long. Okay, on today's show, I wrangled Josh Glazer to talk about using supervised machine learning methods in neuroscience. I probably should have done a show like this at the very beginning, because Josh wrote a paper that really holds your hand and walks you through the many uses of machine learning in neuroscience. And he was kind enough to essentially step through some of the main points from that paper. But I encourage you, if you're interested, to read the original. It's super accessible and it reads well. We also talk about another of his papers, one that you can use as a tutorial to learn how to use some of these machine learning tools. So he tested a bunch of decoding algorithms on a few sets of neural data that they recorded. He provides the code and the neural data via GitHub. So after this show, go get cracking. We talk about plenty more, of course, including how Josh believes that the cerebellum harbors information about a person's ice cream preferences, or something like that. Show notes are at brainInspired.co/podcast/8, or connect with me on Twitter, at PGMID, PGMID. Okay, enjoy, Josh Glazer. Josh Glazer, thanks for speaking with me, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I reached out to you because you wrote these two excellent papers about using machine learning as a tool in neuroscience. Both of them are available online, and I'll link to them in the show notes. So they fit right into the mission of this show here to explore the intersection of neuroscience and AI. And it's funny, you hesitated to agree to come on because I know you're in a transition right now. So you recently finished your PhD, and congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
Are you finding that you're getting any more respect in the world?
That's pretty similar. I get a few fun comments getting called doctor, but for the most part, I felt respected enough during the PhD, which I was happy about. So No huge changes.
Yeah, you don't feel too different. Maybe just a little healing from the beating that is earning a PhD. So anyway, the work that we'll talk about today, you've already moved beyond it because it's old hat to you. And I can relate to that because once a paper actually comes out, you've been working on it so long that, you know, you're kind of tired of it. And I know that you're going to start a postdoc soon where you'll be doing new cool stuff at the intersection of neuroscience and AI as well. So thanks for letting me bore you a bit here. And I will just extend an open invitation to you to come back anytime and we can talk about whatever new work you're doing. Sound good?
That sounds great.
Okay, cool. So in a few minutes, we're going to talk about your work testing different types of supervised machine learning tools to decode some neural data that you recorded. Before we do that, let's start off with an overview of how supervised machine learning can help in systems neuroscience. So this is from a review that you and your colleagues wrote called, appropriately enough, The Roles of Supervised Machine Learning in Systems Neuroscience. Okay, so this is all about supervised learning, which is what's mostly used in technologies to predict outputs from inputs. Like you input an image, and the machine learning system determines whether there's an ice cream cone in the image, for example. So in this case, you'd input a ton of pictures and images, some of which have ice cream cones and some don't. And a supervised learning system trains on these pictures for which you already know the answer. Then you can test the machine learning answers against the real answers. And the machine learning system improves over the training until it's really good at recognizing when there's an ice cream cone in an image. So that's an example of supervised machine learning. What are the other types of machine learning and how do they differ from supervised?
So one of the main other types is unsupervised learning. So right, as you said, supervised learning, you generally have all the inputs and the outputs. And in unsupervised learning, it's often thought to you just have the inputs, or you could also think of it as only having outputs, but you just have kind of one data set, and you're more concerned with finding the structure in this data. So if you think of supervised learning as, you know, mapping X the input to Y the output, in unsupervised learning, you're finding just things within X or mapping X to itself. So there's, in terms of finding structure in the data, some examples would be things like clustering. So let's say you have a lot of different types of, you know, DNA or RNA that are recorded across different cell types. And you don't think that every single one of the cells that you have gene expression for is completely unique. Maybe you think they fall into some different classes. So you have this data set and you could do clustering on it to find kind of different groups of cells that are more similar in terms of their gene expression. And so that would be one example of unsupervised learning. Or in neuroscience, dimensionality reduction is used a lot to, when you have, you know, hundreds or maybe thousands of neurons, you want to find patterns that, you know, maybe span just a few dimensions, kind of a few common modes that you can see. So you can visualize it, and that can help you understand things better than just looking at 100 neurons individually, which is, you know, very challenging to do.
Indeed.
And gets more challenging as data sets grow.
Right, which they're growing at a rapid rate right now.
And so unsupervised learning is one method besides supervised, and then reinforcement learning is another common method. And so generally in reinforcement learning, rather than having, you know, an input that's directly tied to the output, it's a system that often wants to learn the kind of best actions at a given, you know, in a given state based on what occurs at the end of a whole sequence of actions. So this is something that, you know, we'd often think about in everyday learning. Maybe I am going through a maze and I take several steps until I see whether I got to the end of the maze. Not that I'm, you know, going through mazes every day.
I was going to ask.
But thinking of a standard reinforcement learning example. Uh-huh. But so you don't actually get the result until the end after you've taken several actions. But through many of these types of sequences, you can learn what's best for, you know, the best action at a given state.
That's great. Okay, so those are the three kind of main camps of machine learning. And so this paper is all about the role of supervised machine learning that it plays in system neuroscience. And you break it down into four main roles. And I'd like to just step through the roles, if that's okay, and just chat about them.
Sounds great.
So role number one is solving engineering problems. So what are some of the types of problems that can be solved here?
I'd say this is the my most common role that, you know, we'd think about all the time is just using machine learning to make predictions for prediction's sake. You know, for example, if we're taking brain activity and want to make predictions from that in order to, you know, control something in the outside world, like a brain-computer interface, so taking brain activity and using it to control a robotic limb, or taking brain activity and using it to predict whether someone's going to have a seizure, or taking, you know, brain activity or structural brain, you know, neuroanatomy data and using it as a diagnostic device to say, does this person, you know, have Alzheimer's or not, or, you know, schizophrenia or not.
So this kind of work is already being used to control like prosthetic limbs for people who have been paralyzed or don't have function of their limbs and various other parts, right?
Yes, absolutely. So I guess in this paper in general, as it was written as a review, it's describing, you know, a lot of things that are in the process of being done and have been done relatively recently. So it's a lot of engineering problems, and along with predicting things from, you know, brain activity, you can do the reverse problem where maybe I'd want to predict brain activity from things in the outside world to use for example, retinal prosthetic. You often want to stimulate realistic seeming activity in the eye so that someone who was blind could see. So you'd want to make more realistic predictions of what kind of, you know, the retinal activity should be based on like a visual image from a camera.
Do we need to understand the brain to solve these engineering types of problems?
So in general, these machine learning kind of black box solutions can be very helpful for these engineering problems, even if we don't understand the brain.
Okay.
Obviously, understanding the brain is important in many other ways, such as for making interventions. But for these engineering approaches, you really don't need to understand it.
So just to ask you to be a little speculative here, thinking about the prosthetics, which is where my mind immediately goes most, but so how integrated do you think that our brains will be with things like AI assistants, you know, in like 30 years or so? So, you know, brain chips, for example, what do you envision and when?
I think that's a really challenging prediction, which I don't have the answer to. I do think the technology on the machine learning side is not that far away, where definitely within 30 years, a lot of this would be possible. I think one big challenge is actually on the hardware side. Like, for example, now for doing a lot of these clinical trials with brain, you know, computer interfaces, the only people who can be involved in the clinical trials are people that have
right.
you know, some kind of life, you know, life-ending illness, because the brain implants currently aren't going to last for a whole lifetime. You know, they start to, the image starts to degrade after several years. And so they're not, we are very far from the stage where people can, you know, easily just have something put in their head that would last a whole lifetime without any issues.
Yeah, it's still really invasive right now as well.
Right. And yeah, even if it did last a long time, as you point out, brain surgery is not a simple task. And
okay. Oh, really? Okay.
You'd probably know more. You've probably actually done some in your experimental days.
Yeah, it's, you know, it is a strange thing to think about. Like, if I'm in a situation where someone has a, like, a bad head injury, you know, or something out in public, I'm probably, among a group of random people, I'm probably the most qualified person to deal with it, which is kind of scary for that person who has the injury, I think. So, okay, so that's using machine learning to solve engineering problems. That's its first role. So let's go on to the second role, which is identifying predictive variables. So what variables are we talking about?
I'd say anything that, any variable of interest related to the brain or the outside world. So there's a lot of overlap in terms of kind of the approach that we take compared to the role one, which was the engineering solutions.
Right.
But I think of role two as kind of actually trying to understand the relationship between the input and output and not only caring about the final prediction.
I see.
So for example, and doing an encoding model. So encoding is trying to predict the activity of a neuron from stimuli in the outside world. So in kind of the engineering approach, I just want to make as accurate of a prediction as possible, maybe so that I can, you know, then stimulate the retina so that I get a realistic image. But in role two, what we're thinking about is that we actually want to understand this relationship better and how, you know, one variable predicts another. So kind of in this model that I'd make of trying to predict the activity of these neurons, I'd want to see which variables from the outside world are predictive. So is it, you know, certain types of colors, certain types of brightness, any type, you know, for the example of a retina, certain types of orientation, things like those types of visual features.
And this is this contrasts with decoding. What is decoding?
Decoding is the reverse approach where we'd be trying to predict variables in the outside world from activity in the brain. So that's something that I talked about before in terms of if you're trying to control a prosthetic, you're taking activity that's in the brain and then using it to control, you know, something outside. So predict movement, for example, movement velocities or forces. And this can be also used in order to try to gain a greater understanding. For example, how much information is within a certain population of neurons about some variable in the outside world. So can I decode movements better from area one of the brain, motor cortex, or area two, premotor cortex? And so what kind of information is different within those areas?
Okay, very good. Two more to go here. So the third role is benchmarking simple models. And I really enjoyed this. And I think this is starting to be used more and more. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about it, but what's the goal here and how does it work?
Along with having just good machine learning models that make accurate predictions, we ultimately want to have simpler human understandable models. That's a lot of the goal of science and understanding. But for these simple models, it would be very helpful to have some kind of benchmark for how well they can do. And so we know that a lot of these machine learning methods provide very good prediction performance. So if we can take a simpler model and kind of compare it to this machine learning benchmark. And so if this simple model does, you know, very close to this machine learning, close to upper bound, then it's more likely that that model is meaningful. And obviously it's not a guarantee, but it's better than if this simple model is extremely far off. It kind of tells you something important is missing from this model.
Yeah, I think that's a powerful tool and can be used for hypothesis generation as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So then the final role, maybe to me the juiciest, is that supervised machine learning models can serve as a model for the brain. So Josh, do our brains and machine learning systems, do they solve the same problems?
So I think that depends what we are training the machine learning system to solve. In general, these machine learning systems are now currently being trained to solve a subset of problems that brains can solve. You know, if you look at all of the machine learning competitions and benchmark data sets, a lot of it is on pretty specific things, on image recognition and things like that. But I think the AI systems and machine learning systems are starting to expand a lot and solve more problems. They're also getting more flexible as opposed to just solving very specific problems.
Do brains and machines think alike, or how do they differ?
So I think there's a lot of big picture similarities. So we can think about, you know, these machines, or I'll talk about deep learning systems in general, is trying to optimize some cost function. And you could think about, you know, the brain as also trying to optimize some cost function for what it's currently doing. And then they're both trying to learn based on errors, and they both have these types of, you know, neurons, whether biological or artificial, you know, whose connection weights are updated over learning. So there's these very big picture similarities between what's going on in a neural network and the brain. But in terms of how everything is actually implemented, most things are actually different. For example, majority of neural networks are based on rates rather than spikes, just general activity. There's a lot of things that are not biologically plausible, like how credit assignment is done. So how the error signal gets, you know, passed back through the network in order to update the weights. In real neurons, often, neurons only have positive or negative weights, so either excitatory or inhibitory, where neural networks, they, you know, can do both depending on who they're talking to. There's no cell types generally in artificial neural networks. So there's this huge number of implementation differences, even if we can think of the big picture maybe being the same. And so I think it brings up a very interesting general question of if we have a lot of similarities between the outputs of these artificial systems and the brain. You know, all the research that's shown that neurons have similar activity in artificial neural networks as the brain.
Right.
Then what is that saying if so much of the implementation is different?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's an interesting question to ponder. And ideally, I think people are trying to make some of the implementation more similar to see, you know, what things are more biological limitations.
It makes me think also of going the other way and trying to get away from using units that are, most like neurons that we currently have and seeing if you can get the same outputs using different ways, you know, go the opposite way and see if that tells you anything about the biological constraints.
Absolutely, I agree. And I think it's even more interesting when you can find some networks that do reproduce results from the brain and some that don't reproduce results from the brain.
Hmm.
And that can help you find out more, you know, what's unique about the brain, and rather than just saying this matches up with the brain, because then there's so many unknown just so many unknowns about what is really forcing this to be similar.
Well, I recently had David Cicillo on, and he uses recurrent neural networks to model a lot of things, like, for example,
right,
how movements, like arm reaches, are encoded. And then just the last episode, I had Dan Yeamans on, and he uses feed-forward hierarchical convolutional neural networks to model the ventral visual system and other sensory, early sensory areas and sensory processes. So, you know, which machine learning tools or systems are best geared for modeling the brain, you think? Are there any other examples worth mentioning, or do you have one or two favorite examples of brain areas or processes that the machine learning has successfully modeled?
I think both David Cicillo and Dan Yeamans' work is, those are probably some of the examples I would have brought up. I think they've done great work both in the visual system and movement system. There's also very cool recent work modeling localization, things that kind of resemble the hippocampal place cells or entorhinal grid cells.
Oh, yeah, I've seen some of that, yeah.
I forget the exact architecture of the neural networks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure they are recurrent also, trained to ultimately predict where they are in this space, and they develop... the cells develop properties that look like properties that you see in the actual brain and the hippocampus and entorhinal cortex. So that's an additional example beyond the ones you mentioned that I think that has come out recently and is very interesting. And getting back to your question of kind of which of these methods is best geared for modeling, I think it largely depends on the system. When you're doing something visual where we know, while there is some recurrence, it's a very hierarchical and largely feed-forward system, then probably that type of neural network is going to perform the task sufficiently well. And then something like movement, where there's a lot of theory now about it being a dynamic system, having recurrence in your model is very important.
Talking to Dan, they came together and made recurrent convolutional neural networks. So it's all coming together, you know, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. And there's clearly feedback in every part of the brain. So I think for any realistic model, you are going to need some type of recurrence.
Okay. You ready to speculate again?
Sure.
How far off are we from modeling the whole brain? I mean, you know, you keep putting these networks together and joining them and explaining the movement and explaining the sensory, and we're getting closer and closer to these watershed, you know, prefrontal cortical areas and things like that. How far off do you think we are?
I'd still say pretty far.
Take the over-under on, let's say, 20 years.
I think saying modeling the brain is a little too vague to put a number or a, or also even a success criterion on it.
Yeah.
So,
well, I guess what I really mean is, let's say the criterion is sufficient to use feedforward convolutional nets to model sensory areas, right? And then you have recurrent neural nets to model movement areas and things like hippocampal place cells. So we're getting to the point where these models are spreading and you know, spreading throughout the brain. And not that we even understand enough about brain areas in general. I mean, these are really, really well understood brain areas that we're talking about, studied mm-hmm. for a long time. So I guess there's a lot more neuroscience to do as well. But I'm just kind of envisioning these pieces falling into place. And then at some point, we're going to connect them together. And it'll be a massive failure for, you know, acting like a brain, I think. But it just, I'm picturing it. So I'm wondering when all those pieces will be available to plug in together.
For that question, I'd say we're probably not super far off. Again, I don't have an exact time estimate, but from when...
Come on, man.
from when we will be able to take a lot of neural nets that have brain-like properties, let's say, and put them together to form some larger system that can do a lot of what humans do and have a lot of the same properties as the brain. I'd say for something like that, just to guess, maybe 10 years.
Oh, wow. All right. I like your attitude there.
That being said, I think that system is still very far from what the brain actually is. And just because you train a neural network and activity emerges that looks very similar to activity in the brain does not necessarily mean that this is what the brain is doing. It can just be that essentially any type of computing system, even if the brain is doing it completely differently from a neural net, will solve this type of computational problem of how to, you know, classify an image. It will do it in a similar way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it ultimately... what I can see, you know, originally predicted in 10 years may still be very far from actually understanding how the brain is implementing this.
Yeah. So, you know, I was in neuroscience for over 10 years, I guess, including my technician work. And my family takes a vacation with my wife's family every year. And we were all sitting around one night and one of her cousins asked me how much we understand about the brain. And I looked at him, I was like, almost nothing, you know, which is embarrassing to say, but that's the way I feel about it. Even though we understand so much, we still understand so little. So,
right. As you learn more, you have more questions.
That's right.
You feel like you know less.
Well, that's right. I'll just ask you this now, since you mentioned that. Talking to Dan, I asked him, Dan Yeamans, in one of his papers, he wrote that every time you answer one question, it gives rise to more questions. And I acknowledge that the beauty of that, for instance, you could get more grants and lead you down to the road to, you know, of curiosity to solve more problems. But doesn't it always also kind of suck because we're supposed to be answering questions, not creating them?
Well, I think I'd have more of the optimistic perspective that we are adding to knowledge and learning new things. And if new questions emerge, they're often more detailed questions. And although obviously there are occasional paradigm shifts that change everything, but often once you have come to some discovery, it still is very satisfying, even if more questions emerge.
Very good. Well, I don't mean to take us too far off track here, but those are the four roles of supervised machine learning. So let's move on and let's zero in on one of the ways mentioned during that, and that's decoding. And just as a reminder, decoding means using neural data, in this case, like spike trains, to predict something in the world, like where someone is reaching in space, for instance. So I love this paper called Machine Learning for Neural Decoding. And it's actually a tutorial on how to use machine learning to decode neural data. And you test a bunch of different machine learning methods on your data. And you explain all the choices you have to make along the way to set up the different decoders. And you offer the code through GitHub, so anyone can go reproduce this if they'd like to. And actually, this morning, I started adapting your code to try it out on my own recordings in frontal eye field.
Great.
Have people contacted you, people who found the code and tried it out on their own data?
Yeah, that's, I think, something that's very nice and rewarding, kind of more instantaneously rewarding than maybe the paper process, which takes very long.
Oh, yeah.
That when you release some code and people are actually able to use it and people contact you, it feels good to make an impact in that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just looking at it today, it looks like it's not going to take too much work for me to be able to adapt it to my own data. So thanks in advance.
Great.
All right. Well, let's talk decoding. Why is it important?
I think this ties back into what we were talking about earlier with different roles of machine learning in neuroscience. So one being kind of engineering purposes, like for prosthetics or brain-computer interfaces, and the other being more of the scientific understanding for knowing how much information is in a brain area so you can compare across brain areas, compare across cell types, different experimental conditions, different disease states, and try to lead to some more understanding about what is going on in the brain.
How has decoding traditionally been accomplished, and how does that compare to the machine learning tools we're going to talk about?
More traditionally, it's been a lot of linear methods that have been used. For example, in movement decoding, it's often been kind of a Wiener filter, which is basically linear regression using time-binned neural data as predictor, or a Kalman filter, which then also kind of takes into account these kinematics that are more continuous, which can be helpful.
And in those cases, you're having to assume a model, really, right?
They're assuming a model in the sense that it is a linear assumption, whereas in some more modern methods, allow all sorts of arbitrary nonlinear, mappings from the neural data to then the output. That being said, I still would call these more traditional methods machine learning tools.
Okay.
At least the way I would define machine learning as, a system where you train the data on one data set.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you give a new data set to the machine or computer, it will be able to make predictions. And it's all done without hard coding any rules.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine a non-machine learning decoding method where I've decided that whenever this neuron fires a lot, the cursor moves to the right, and I've hard-coded that in. However, the way even the traditional linear methods work, just like linear regression, is that you are training it on training data, and then it learns the mapping by itself that it can use.
Okay, very good. So let's say I was recording neurons from the cerebellum, and you make a decoder that can predict what kind of ice cream someone prefers. I don't know why I'm talking about ice cream so much today. Does it mean that the cerebellum is responsible for ice cream preference?
Absolutely not. So it means that the cerebellum has information about ice cream preference. It's really, like most machine learning methods, it's purely correlational. We don't actually know whether this region is responsible for ice cream preference or whether it's information from some other brain area that has been passed on. So for a maybe more realistic neuroscience example than cerebellum and ice cream preference.
I'm going to quote you on, I think I now have a recording of you saying the cerebellum has information on ice cream preference. That's good.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it wouldn't completely surprise me.
Well, sure.
Yeah. Considering how distributed information is, I wouldn't say there's a lot of information, but right. I wouldn't be completely shocked.
I'm not going to ask you to bet on it. So, okay. But go ahead with your real example.
An example that I, you know, mentioned in the paper was that if you had recordings from a huge number of neurons in the retina, so retinal ganglion cells, you would be able to, with a good decoder, decode what kind of image is being viewed.
Mm.
That doesn't mean that the retina is, you know, directly responsible, or its primary role is to do image classification.
That's a good example.
Right. It means that, right, the retina, because it has all of this visual information, is going to ultimately have information about what image is there, but the data is in much more raw of a form, obviously.
Okay, so like I mentioned, you tested multiple decoders on data that you recorded. So what was the data that you recorded and used as input to the machine learning tools, these decoders? And then what variables in the environment did these tools predict?
So I used three different data sets that we compared several methods on. So we had data sets from motor cortex and somatosensory mm-hmm. cortex. And for both of those, we had a task that was a reaching task. And we were ultimately predicting the X and Y velocity of the reach.
And these were from macaque, rhesus
macaques. Yes, these were from rhesus macaque monkeys. And then in a separate data set, which was from hippocampal neurons, we were predicting position. And that was from rats who were wandering around the platform.
Okay, so let's meet the contestants here. So we've talked about the basic concepts behind feed-forward networks and recurrent neural networks on past episodes on the show. But it would be good to just give a brief description of how some of these guys operate. So we don't need to go through all of them, since you tested 10 or so, I believe, but maybe you can describe some of the major players and I'll hop in with questions along the way. Sound good?
Yeah, that sounds good. Right. So there were 10 techniques, so I won't go through all of them. So there's some classic ones like the linear mappings like Wiener filter and Kalman filter, like I mentioned, and some nonlinear extensions to those like Wiener cascade or a support vector regression. Then I also had several more modern like neural network type methods, so feed forward ones, and then also a few different types of recurrent neural networks, including gated ones. So
okay,
like a gated recurrent unit or LSTM. And finally, we had an ensemble method, which basically took predictions from all of the other methods and then what's called stacking. So we had another neural net built on top of those predictions that then made a final prediction. So it kind of tries to leverage information from all of the other ones. And ideally, it takes the best of all of them and not the worst of all of them.
Okay. So I should mention that it would have been untenable for you to test every possible variation of, you know, parameter structures, et cetera, within all of these models. That is called a combinatorial explosion. But you did test a bunch, and you go over all these issues in the paper, too. It's really well-written paper. So
Thank you.
So what was the fallout? Who won?
I'd say somewhat unsurprisingly, a lot of the neural network methods worked very well, in particular the LSTM and feed-forward neural network often did very well. The LSTM often a drop better than the feed-forward neural network on these data sets.
Just to jump in, the LSTM is one of the modern recurrent neural networks.
Yes, exactly. So the ensemble, which kind of leveraged all of the predictions, always did the best, but it was very slight. It was often, you know, 1% better than the LSTM. So you're not seeing a drastic jump in performance by combining
and
everything.
What range of what percentage correct are we talking about for the winners or on average?
So it depended on the task, and because this was predicting continuous variables like velocity or position. It's given R squared value rather than, you know, how close they corresponded rather than percent correct.
I see. Yeah.
But often for, you know, the motor cortex data set for the LSTM, you know, often got up to around, you know, 0.8 R squareds. The somatosensory cortex might have been, trying to remember, maybe around 0.75 in the hippocampus, okay, which was a sparser data set, was maybe around 0.6.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is off data sets where it's by no means a ton of data. I mean, you were dealing with not as much data as maybe a big data, you might call big data, but they still performed really well. So the ensemble did the best, and then in general, right behind it was a type of recurrent neural network. Right behind that was a feed forward, but the feed forward did better than other, like the simple recurrent neural network. I mean, is this surprising to you, or is this what you expected? Were there other surprises?
Yeah, that was surprising to me. I guess just in general, the types of gated recurrent neural networks, like the LSTM, often are advantageous over a standard recurrent neural network because they have better memory that they can better take into account, I guess in this case, neural activity from many time steps before. And I actually thought in this type of data set where things may just go back a few hundred milliseconds for how much they matter, often it wouldn't matter that much to have a, you know, LSTM versus recurrent neural network. Mm-hmm. So I was a little surprised that it was helpful, but nonetheless, I guess that it still can be 10 time bins or so into the past. So yeah, that was a bit of a surprise. I'd say the biggest surprise to me was that, I guess what we've generally been talking about is my main analysis where I had just kind of the full data set. And as you said, that was not big data by any means. It was a standard neuroscience recording. So 20 minutes for one of the data sets, 40 minutes for another of the data sets. But I was very surprised that the results held when going to very limited data. For example, with the motor somatosensory cortex data sets, we could train them on just a minute or two, and it would still way outperform the simple linear methods.
Well, yeah, and I guess I buried the lead a little bit here because the big take home was that all of the modern network architectures performed much better than the traditional methods, right?
Yeah, that was, I'd say, generally the case. One minor caveat is, so there's a method I didn't mention before, naive Bayes, which is, I'd say, more traditionally used for a lot of hippocampal decoding. And so it has some kind of prior information that is baked into it, which on the hippocampal data set turned out to be pretty helpful because it was a very sparse data set. And so in that case, the neural network still outperformed, but it was closer. I would not say it was substantial.
Okay. This is, you win some sort of prize. I think you're the first person on the show to say Bayes, B-A-Y-E-S. So it'll probably be mentioned on future episodes too. Well, all right, everyone, go download and play with the code that does all of this stuff. And the paper is super accessible, or at least for me, and I'm not that bright. So you guys will all have a better time reading this. So Josh, this is cool work, and it's all about using machine learning tools to understand the brain better. What was the biggest struggle that you had to overcome to get this work done?
So,
the sigh. I hear the sigh. That's good.
I'm not sure.
So, I mean, it's interesting because you use machine learning tools. It's built on TensorFlow, and you use Keras.
Right.
And looking at the code, it's all like really nice and straightforward, and it's nice coding as well. But it looked like it was easy to put together, and I thought that cannot be the case.
So yeah, that is accurate. Things now look way prettier than they did a year ago. And I think getting clean code that is easily readable by other people definitely was a big challenge of this. And I think it's something to strive for really in all projects in the future.
That in itself, you should win some huge award for.
Because I definitely have had other projects where I don't have it as clean and I need to go back to my own code 2 years later. And it definitely takes a little while figuring out what I was thinking 2 years ago.
Oh, it's the worst to look at your own code from the past. I often would tell people coding, you're terrible at it, and then you learn a little bit and you think, all right, I'm pretty good. And then a year later, you look back and think, I was terrible, but now I'm good. And then you look back a year later and the cycle continues, you know?
Yeah, it's very true. So it was a very good experience making sure I had this cleaned up and accessible. And, fingers crossed, I will continue to try to do that for all my future code.
Yeah, well, good luck. But this is all about machine learning tools, using machine learning tools to understand the brain better. I mean, what do you think brain science can contribute to AI research?
Yeah, so I think a great deal, mainly in terms of new ideas that are coming into AI from neuroscience. So there's already a lot of general inputs into the architecture of deep learning systems. So, for example, adding attention or working memory into a lot of these neural network systems that has significantly improved performance in a lot of domains. Or the brain is much more efficient energy-wise than neural networks now. So probably a lot can be learned from neural computation so that we don't, completely use all of our energy on deep learning and not only on mining bitcoins.
Right. So do you think that this is the start of something big in neuroscience? So will we see the advent of machine learning tools in neuroscience research? Will we see that as the key that led us to a general theory of the brain, for instance?
I'll say yes and no. So I'll say yes to being something big in neuroscience. I think as larger data sets are emerging, it's extremely important to have more sophisticated tools to analyze these larger data sets. And it's an important loop in experiments and data analysis. But ultimately, we do need theory also. So kind of the way machine learning is applied, the way we have been talking about it today, the theories don't appear from the machine learning. It's more of a data analysis technique. And so I don't know if there truly is a general theory of the brain, but in order to get some, let's just say, more general principles, I think there definitely needs to be more theory, and it'll be important to have crosstalk, not only between experiments and machine learning, but also people doing data analysis and machine learning with those doing theory. It's trying to, kind of merge those together will be very helpful.
Oh, you're preaching to the choir here, of course. So we've traditionally worked with single neurons to figure out how the brain works. But these days we record from a ton more neurons, and it has some people rethinking what's functionally important to consider when thinking about how to explain how the brain works. And we're using these AI tools that people are starting to analyze at the population level as well. Will the neuron doctrine, this doctrine that focuses on the importance of single neurons, will that be replaced, you think, with a network doctrine?
Yes. And I think it already...
It's dead?
I wouldn't say it's dead. I think the transition is already occurring.
Oh, okay.
Maybe it's possible I'm in a silo, but...
Right.
At least among people I talk with, the transition is already occurring pretty quickly.
It's hard to avoid. Yeah. Does all this machine learning success, like yours and other people's, does it make you think less highly of our brain's abilities or more highly of computers or something else?
I would say more highly of the brain's capabilities, actually. I think it's very impressive, what these machine learning and AI systems are capable of doing. And given that the brain is still so far beyond that, in most domains, I think is just impressive how capable our brains are.
What's something that you believe is true or will become true, but you can't prove?
I would speculate that the colors that you see are perceptually very similar to the ones that I see.
Oh, that's such a good answer. Yeah, we'll have to do a special on that or something. The qualia. Nice. Okay. So so you are transitioning to a new postdoc. Congratulations on getting the position.
Thank you.
Can you talk about what you might be working on in your postdoc and maybe what people, if you come back on the show, what they might be hearing about?
Yeah, so I'll be starting a postdoc at Columbia working with Liam Paninsky and John Cunningham, still doing more machine learning applied to neuro. In my PhD, it was a lot of applying current machine learning tools to neuroscience problems, and I hope to do some more on the machine learning development side, not purely just application. And I think one interesting question in general, we briefly talked before about, you know, some differences between kind of the brain and machine learning systems. And so one thing is that machine learning systems ignore a lot of biology. For example, different cell types. And a lot of those things are completely ignored, or different brain areas. And so trying to integrate some of that biological knowledge into some machine learning methods, I think, is a interesting path forward.
That's great. Well, good luck with that. When you said you're going to be working more on the machine learning development side, it makes me think there are a lot of people who are going from the neuroscience world to then they get interested in thinking about working with the machines more. You know, and my experience in graduate school is people would come in with a big interest, you know, how to figure out consciousness or something like that. And then you kind of start working on a smaller problem and a smaller problem, a different, more detailed problem. And then you end up working on something and being interested in something completely different than you knew you were interested in. And I wonder if this is happening to a lot of neuroscientists that are starting to use these tools where they actually become their interest shifts from understanding the brain so much to understanding these machines. It's interesting to think about.
I do think it's very interesting. And I think in some ways, the machines can be a very accessible model system, easier to analyze than doing year-long experiments on certain animals. And so, obviously there are, it's just a model system, and you don't know, you know, how similar it is to the human brain. But ideally, you can find some, you know, general principles of computation in these, you know, model machine learning systems, and then can use that to understand the brain a little more. And I think that's a lot of people's motivation.
Well, Josh, I've enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for taking the time. I will let you get back to whatever it is that you're doing, solving problems. So thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, now we all know exactly what supervised machine learning can do for neuroscience. Looking forward to hearing what projects Josh is going to be having in the future. I will be sure to have him back on. Thanks to Josh for joining me today. Thank you for listening. Again, you can find all the show notes, etc. at braininspired.co. See you next time.